When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Germany podcast. Today is a special episode because I have a guest from, well, I wanted to cover a kind of Danish topic. And I mentioned this on the Saxon miniseries. I kept mentioning this in passing in when these German emperors would head north. And so instead of trying to explain this, I thought it'd be better if I have a guest on the show. And I talked the host of the History of Denmark into popping up. So we have Søren Krarup here. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Travis. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and welcome. And so what is...
Thanks.
Is this something that you learned about in school, the Danevirke? I mean, I guess we should back up and define this first. What are we really talking about today? What is the Danevirke? And also, how do you pronounce it? What's it really called?
Okay, so in Danish, it's called Danevirke. Mm-hmm. And I usually, on my show, I try to use the English versions of Danish words. So I say Jutland instead of Jylland. Yeah. But Danevirke doesn't really have an English translation as far as I can see. So I just say the Danevirke fortification. But yeah. It actually just means, it just literally means Danish fortification if you translate
exactly.
It.
So yeah, like the Danish.
Danevirke fortification works fine. Yep. But yeah, in terms of learning about it in school, we don't really encounter it until talking about the Second Schleswig War. And then usually it gives like an overview that this is actually an old fortification, but it's not important enough that we actually learn about it when talking about the history of Denmark in the 900s, for example.
Because we'll get to this, obviously, but I was reading that it was such a Danish symbol. It was just such a national symbol. Okay, but anyways.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
So what is it? What is the Danevirke?
Well, it's a fortification that cuts across the Jutland Peninsula in the south, and it's the traditional border of the of Jutland and the Duchy of Schleswig.
Yeah, like
a, and it's
yeah.
like it's it's an earthen wall, and then it's been strengthened a few times with different materials.
Yeah, people can kind of imagine like it's the same idea behind like the Hadrian's Wall in Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
You're at this very narrow point in Jutland. I still say Jutland, but that's just German pronunciation. But anyway, but
whatever works.
Yeah, I'm like, it's not Jutland. I would never say Jutland on my show. But yeah, I heard you say that on your show. I thought that was funny. It's just kind of like where there's the thinnest point of Denmark of Jutland. Mm. There's this earthen works with did you say it was like 30 kilometers long, is that what you...
Yeah, something like that. But you have to remember it's because there's a river that's going north south.
Yeah,
so the Danevirke doesn't go all the way across Jutland. It just goes from the eastern coast to the river,
to that river. Yeah,
because the river acts as a defense.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and then I guess it's we should point out that it kind of evolved over time. So this was at first it was
very earthwork. Much very much
yeah and if we go into the history of it, so can you give me, do you know the sort of evolution of it? Like what, we'll talk about the history later, but what did it look like in the beginning versus the end kind of thing?
Yeah, we don't really know how old it is because as it is with like early Danish history, we have absolutely terrible sources or
just legends.
In many cases, no sources at all. Yeah. And especially the sagas, that's pretty much the best thing we have. But those are written down in like the 1200s or something in Iceland. So that's already like 300 years of oral, of passing down orally before being written down in Christian times in the medieval period. So with all things in early Danish and Scandinavian history, we can't say anything for sure. But we can use dendrochronology, which is when you cut a tree apart and then you can count the rings kind of to date things. That's how we date the earliest fortifications at Jelling, which was the old old royal city in early Denmark. Mm-hmm. And you can also do that on the palisade on the Dannevirke. And the palisade is not the first phase of the wall, but it was added around 740, around that year.
So there you got a date, yeah.
But before that, for the palisade, the wooden palisade, before that there was also like an earthen wall, mm-hmm. but we don't know how old it is. It could be all the way back from the 500s or maybe just the 700s. We can't really say for sure.
Yeah.
But then later in the 1100s, King Valdemar the Great fortified the wall with bricks and some towers and stuff. And mm-hmm. then after that, it was pretty much abandoned. Jutland has been invaded a few times since that, but it wasn't really used in that context because it wasn't really strong enough to hold off either.
Okay. Because I was even thinking
the Germans or Swedes.
Yeah, well, if the battles were further south or north or, you know, yeah, or, in, you know, yeah, yeah. Just, it just
and also
it
at that
matter.
Time, Denmark had both the duchies of Schleswig and Holstein, so Danish territory extended south beyond the Dannevirke, so it wasn't really a border between Denmark and Germany anymore. But also, Denmark didn't, after Valdemar strengthened its bricks, it wasn't really used that much because Denmark didn't really fight with the whole Roman Empire. Until the 30 Years' War in the 1600s. So, it did fight with the Hanseatic League, like Lübeck, and I mention that all the time in my podcast, that Lübeck allied with Sweden and then attacked Denmark or defended against Denmark. But that was usually like naval attacks, so it wasn't really relevant.
Yeah. Naval battles or from the north.
Or transporting troops, really, landing them on the Danish Isles or... Yeah. going around or something.
Not coming from Germany and marching north through that.
I was going to say, when the Germans really concentrated their forces on the Danube, as they did like with Tilly in the 30 Years' War, wasn't really strong enough to hold them off. So if they just put all their effort into it, they could break it. It's not like...
Episode I just had was it Otto the Second, I think. He marched right through, basically. No problem, you know. Yeah. That was Harald Bluetooth, actually. But there was one interesting thing I came across, which was before modern archaeology kind of told us that it was, you know, from all the way back to the 600s, potentially. There was a theory for centuries. There was a theory of who built it and that kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I should have mentioned that actually.
Okay.
But that's also a common theme in early Danish history, because so what they believed was that the wife of Harald Bluetooth, his mother, the wife of Gorm the Old, Tyra Danebod. That she ordered it built, kind of. That's also like a romantic vision of the queen ordering the fortification being built. But what this is like a product of is just us not knowing when it's actually from, and then just ascribing it the earliest possible king or queen or important figure. Because as we know, it's probably much older, but Tyra and Gorm the Old. Are the earliest kings, so we just say he did everything.
I mean, you can just imagine, like in later centuries, they say, "Oh, this goes all the way back to who?" Well, to Bluetooth's mother's time, you know, or the famous Gorm the Old, or you know, the famous builder that built everything that we don't know who built it. Mm-hmm. Archaeology shows us it's centuries older than that, even like 400, 500 years older than Tyra and. That's interesting. I mean, there's other works at the same time, I guess we should mention, like Offa's Dyke. And there's other building projects happening in this era in Denmark. And there was another theory that was the earliest stages might have not even been defensive. It might have been like a canal for, you know, for shipping, for trade kind of thing.
Like the Kiel Canal.
Yeah. Because there was a canal on both sides of the ramparts or something strange. So it's like it wasn't a moat because it didn't make sense. Like, why was there also a moat on the north side? So they figured, this must be, so then let's see what else. I just mentioned in a couple episodes ago, I did mention Harald Bluetooth. This was kind of, I guess, the second phase of building because there was, you know, earlier works and then... an improvement done in the I guess in the 10th century. Mm-hmm. Franks mentioned something in the 9th century, I guess, which must have been before Harold. The point is that people were building on it throughout the centuries. Otto II, I mentioned. So Otto II, this is a story I've heard before, which I thought was neat, which Otto the Great was allies with Denmark and Harald Bluetooth, but Otto II not. And he went off to war. There was fight and there was, you know, tribute not being paid.
Yes, several times, actually.
Yeah. But eventually there was a peace. And then there was according to legend, I guess, there was this symbolic gesture done where Denmark was left a door or a gate so that the emperor could come to Harald's court. You know, it was just like symbolic. I don't think he ever used it.
I hadn't actually heard about that, but it seems likely, or at least I get the point of the legend, even if it's not completely accurate.
Yes, yeah.
If you look at a map of Europe at this point, like the whole Roman Empire is huge, and Denmark has just formed as a kingdom. Mm-hmm. So Denmark was really threatened by their southern neighbor, and also Denmark was still pagan at this time.
Right.
So this whole threatening southern neighbor also played a role why Denmark converted to Christianity. There were all other reasons also, because it gave them like legitimacy, an organized kingdom, and also let them attack Sweden and Norway, because if they were still pagan and Denmark was Christian, then it's easier to justify wars against those.
Yep.
But yeah, so Harald Bluetooth, at least it played a part that Otto II was so aggressive. So Harald maybe thought that if he converted to Christianity, then he could gain some peace on the border, which didn't work out in the end, but I guess it did kind of relieve some tension.
So that is where I was in the history of Germany in the chronological miniseries. But so the Dänemarca, obviously the history goes on and it's really interesting. And I'll probably never really bring it up again. Like I don't even know when I'll get to the 19th century, but it'll probably take me decades. But it does become a national symbol, and we have to remember that from the time it was built for another millennia, really, it was within Denmark. I mean, it's even called the Danish Works, okay? But now, and it was expanded a couple times, but mostly, like you said, it was abandoned for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. But let's jump ahead to the 1800s, okay? So we have, I would say, yeah, so it's... I'll let you talk because I think this is also one of your, I mean, you know a lot about this, especially the second Schleswig War it's just the German-Danish War, the second German-Danish War. 64?
Every Dane knows that year.
Yeah, so go ahead. Tell me from the Danish point of view, I don't know. I mean, I didn't go to school in Germany until the very end. I went to an American high school. But I never learned about this part in school. But I imagine in Denmark, just because it's such a national symbol, you do know about this. So yeah, please.
Yeah, it's so important. Okay, yeah. So usually the way this is explained... is by going back to post-Napoleonic Europe in 1815, because with Napoleon conquering so much territory and having such a huge influence, he also spread nationalism in Europe and like created this new order where the borders were set in a certain way. But with these nationalist ideas, which were basically, if you boil it down, it's just every people should have one nation each, basically.
Yeah.
So all the Danes should be living in the same nation and all the Germans, for example. Mm-hmm. But borders didn't really correspond to this because Denmark, for example, had Denmark proper, but then also the duchies of Schleswig and Holstein, and then also Lauenburg, which was attached to Holstein. But in northern Schleswig, there were majority Danish people, but in southern Schleswig, it was majority German, and then all the way down, just Germans all over the place. So Denmark didn't actually, or a large part of the Danish population who were nationalists actually didn't want Holstein and Lauenburg as a part of Denmark because you might think more territory is good, but they really believed Danes should all be in the same country, and we don't want the Germans in Holstein and Lauenburg to be a part of Denmark. So these were called the National Liberals. So they were basically classical liberalists who were also nationalistic.
Yeah.
And they wanted Holstein and Lauenburg to be basically expelled from Denmark or released from Denmark, and then have Schleswig absorbed into Denmark, like as an integral part of Denmark instead of being a separate duchy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it's a legal distinction, basically, but there was a bit with different laws and stuff. But
yeah,
basically, they just wanted all the Danes into Denmark, and then the Germans could join up the other Germans.
What I want to mention was, yes, there was the language. I guess in the 19th century, the German-Danish language border kind of crept north a little bit. But what made Schleswig and Holstein their separate duchies. I don't remember the details exactly, but it was basically a change in law where it was ambiguous, because in Denmark's law, maybe a woman could inherit a duchy, and in Germany's law they couldn't. So there was, like, depending on who you asked, there was two different dukes of Schleswig and Holstein or something like that. Like, it was kind of just this weird...
That's not quite accurate, because they've been separate duchies for like hundreds of years, like all the way back to the Middle Ages. But then the king, in many cases, basically, there's a running joke on my show. I haven't really said that it's a running joke, but to me it is that if the history of Denmark were a drinking game, you have to take a shot every time the duchies of Schleswig and Holstein are divided, because nearly every episode they're divided in some new crazy way, where you have four dukes at the same time, and one of them is also the king, and it's so confusing. But basically, the duchies are divided up with several mini dukes. Some of them are just titular, where they don't actually hold any lands, mm-hmm. but they're considered dukes, and some of them do have small lands. And one of them is the Danish king at the same time.
Yes.
For example, in the episode I just did on the 30 Years' War, King Christian IV of Denmark actually declares war on Germany as Duke of Holstein and not as King of Denmark.
Right.
So he just says, Denmark is not declaring war. The Duke of Holstein, which is also me, is declaring war. So again, the confusing legal stuff. Mm-hmm. But to get back to the Schleswig War, it's obviously the second Schleswig War. So the first one was in 1848. And that was pretty much a German rebellion in the duchies, where they wanted to separate from Denmark also.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, the National Liberals didn't have enough, because they basically wanted the same. They wanted the Germans out, so that would be fine with them. But at this point, they didn't have enough power, so it was just a rebellion which was crushed, basically. So Denmark won the first Schleswig War. Then the second one, Prussia is starting to gain leadership in the North German Confederation, like the alliance of German states, and they wanted the duchy, or at least Holstein, and a part of Schleswig. So they joined with Austria, Austria-Hungary, I guess, or is it just Austria at this point?
Austria-Hungary.
Yeah, Austria-Hungary. Okay.
Yeah.
And they declare war on Denmark, and so they just steamroll Denmark completely. And the Danevirke is like, there was this idea that, the huge foreign powers are coming to attack us, but we'll rally at the Danevirke again, drive them back or something. But now, that was just a complete fantasy, because
it was just a ruin.
It didn't have any defensive properties.
I think it became symbolic at that point that they thought that in their minds it was this huge
wishful thinking.
Yeah. But also, I mean, they did also modernize it in this time. So it was outfitted with, like, so you have this ancient, like, earthworks with a palisade. Now, well, it had bricks, I guess.
But still,
it's
the,
like,
Prussians and the Austrians.
And nothing.
But
it
still,
nothing.
It's not enough, because the Prussians and Austrians were better trained, better equipped, more numerous, and better logistics and everything. They had everything on their side, and Denmark was just trying to convince itself that, this will be like Thermopylae and we'll beat back the Persians or something, but...
Right, yep.
They just...
This is where we'll take
our
stand.
The generals were in charge of it. When they saw the Prussian Austrians come, they just fled north and basically abandoned the Danevirke without a fight. The real battle was at a mill called Düppel Mill. Mm-hmm. And the Danes tried to hold out, but the Prussians bombarded them for a long time and wore them down. And then they just stormed the ramparts.
Yeah.
And there were like several rounds of negotiations, but they all broke down or didn't resolve the situation. So the war eventually continued, and Denmark just got rolled over. And eventually they had to cede both, like everything south of Jutland. So both Schleswig and Holstein and Lauenburg, including mm-hmm. the Danes in those areas. So the war was just a complete disaster for Denmark. We're talking a third of Denmark lost.
Yeah. It's a big chunk war.
And it's really very good farmland, and the economy mm-hmm. was just devastated after this.
Yeah.
And remember, this is after losing Norway in the Napoleonic Wars to Sweden. And the economy already being totally down the drain after those wars. Then 50 years goes by and you lose another third of your entire country.
If you look at the 50-year span, Denmark was a rump state. But Europe changed so much in the Napoleonic Wars. It's like, well, yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, but Denmark definitely. It was very different to like the definition of Denmark changed a lot in 50 years. That's for sure.
Yeah. And also something I forgot to mention with the first Schleswig War. The Prussians supported the German rebels, but Denmark was backed by Russia. And basically the only way Denmark won that war was because England and Russia wanted to control Prussian power. So they supported Denmark in that first war.
Yeah.
But Denmark wasn't really able to secure proper support in the second one. And so they just got rolled over. And also this is this 1864 war with Prussia. If you see it from Prussia's perspective, it was also the first of the three wars of German unification,
right?
Where they assembled all the German states. One war against Denmark, then they turned around and attacked the Prussians. The Austrians rather, and then the 1870 war with France.
Yep.
To take Alsace-Lorraine, and with those three wars, they formed the German Empire.
Yeah.
So that's also pretty important for German history.
Yeah. And so this was just like one of the campaigns basically those major wars.
Yeah, this was probably the easiest one of those three.
The practice round, but yeah, major blow for
We'll practice for on Denmark. The Danes, then we'll take on the Austrians.
Ah, jeez. Yeah.
So embarrassing. But basically in terms of the cultural impact of this can't be understated, because as we just said before the war, every Dane thought that this Danevirke fortification was impenetrable, mm-hmm. but then they just got completely crushed in the war. So they developed this mentality in Denmark of, okay, we're losing a lot of territory and we can't win wars, but our culture is really great. So everybody just decided to focus on painting paintings and writing poems and stuff like that. Denmark kind of enters a golden age in the 1800s, even though they lost Norway in the Napoleonic Wars and lost the duchies and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where you see a lot of the famous Danish paintings and national anthems and stuff like that. That comes from this period.
Yeah.
Because even though they were just getting smashed in terms of war, they just decided, okay, we'll try the cultural stuff instead. It's
like an inward focus and just this renaissance. And
Exactly.
Yeah.
In school, we learned that, just quickly, in school, we learned that the motto for this period is what is lost outwardly must be won inwardly. That was the slogan at the time.
There you go. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
And also, often on my show, I say, there's a famous painting of this event. That's almost always from the 1800s, because that's where all the historic paintings are made also. Where they like glorify the past.
That's good to know. The romanticism movement, that kind of happened a lot.
Exactly.
But that is good to know as a student if you're studying that stuff. You're like, there's when Denmark shrank, that's when all the good stuff, the good artwork happened.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
it's a good rule of thumb.
Had to compensate some way.
Yeah, there's one more part of the Danevirke's history I want to get to. It's the last chapter, maybe, in the 20th century. This is just kind of a neat little story, but in the Second World War,
Germans... we should do the First World War first.
Oh, okay. Well,
we jumped over the First World War just quickly.
The First War was go ahead. Yeah,
because the First World War actually established the modern borders, because Germany obviously lost the First World War, so there was a referendum in all parts of the lost duchies, and this is only 50 years war, 50 years after they lost the duchies. Mm-hmm. So after the First World War, there were referendums where the people could decide, do we want to join Denmark or stay with Germany? And each region voted. So what ended up happening was that Northern Schleswig, which had majority Danish population, they rejoined Denmark.
Yeah.
And all the rest south just rejoined Germany. So Danneberg is still in Germany today, but Denmark at least regained Northern Schleswig. This caused a bit of a crisis because the king at this point, the king of Denmark, he wanted the German city of Flensburg, which is just south of the border. He wanted that to be part of Denmark.
Yep.
And because of that, he actually triggered a constitutional crisis where he fired the prime minister because the prime minister didn't want Flensburg to be Danish.
That was
and then he just said,
you
don't support my policy? I'll just appoint a new prime minister. But then the people started to get really upset that he was overreaching and everything. So this is called the Easter Crisis of 1920. And this is what eventually broke the Danish monarchy's hope of restoring their power. So after that, they just accepted and said, okay, we'll not meddle in politics anymore, basically.
Because you can't just do that.
And then they became, they accepted constitutional monarchy and became like figurehead monarchs.
Yeah, the king tries to fire the prime minister, that's when that's if he can't do that.
But he thought it would be a popular move.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean maybe it's a balance of power, But no, that's just crazy, obviously. Yeah. That is actually very important for modern Danish history too, that the role of the king kind of changed in that event. And that event was Flensburg. That was over this the question of where the border would be. So that's a good point. I do want to get to this great story in World War II, which is they're almost the Danneberg was kind of saved because it was almost turned into a German like redoubt and defensive structure.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, Denmark got invaded by Germany. We should say for those who don't know, that's obvious. I just feel like stating it. But 1940, we got invaded and lost in 6 hours.
6 hours. Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah, because they made simultaneous attack both the southern border and airdropping people all over the country. So.
Yeah,
got,
just chaos internally, and that was it. Yep.
Yeah, took the capital with U-boats and airdropping people.
But
no chance.
If you go to the Danneverka today, you'll see that it's not overhauled into a German armored fortification, but it still has the old 19th century stuff to it. So how did it, you know the story, I believe, how it got saved by this Danish. Was he worked in a museum or something? He was like a curator or what's the story?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't really looked into like which persons were involved in this event, but basically the Germans considered turning the Danneberg into an actual armored fortification that could actually be used in the Second World War. But then the Danes cleverly argued that it was Aryan heritage, and obviously the Nazis want to protect Aryan heritage, so in that way they got the Germans to leave it as it was.
So they left it as it was, which is preserved
in that way by using Nazi logic.
Exactly, which is horrible, but is also hilarious. I mean, and I think, I mean, there's a good chance that the guy in the... I forgot his name completely, but it was a museum curator, museum manager or something. And there's a good chance that he was, even though he was Danish, he might have been in the Nazi party or something. So I don't want to like say that he was...
Some Danes were, so...
Yeah, so I don't want to say like, he was super clever and he's possible. A hero. But in fact, he did save, through this Nazi logic, he was able to talk them out of... I believe he wrote a letter to Himmler himself. And told Himmler about it personally or something to kind of say like, look, this goes back to this and this is this Aryan stuff that you're always looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
So leave it alone. And they did. So you can go see it. You'll see the 19th century kind of modifications, but you'll see the Danish modifications. There are no Nazi modifications. So that's good.
Yeah. And also after the Second World War, when Denmark got liberated again, there was a small political force. I guess it had some popularity, but they wanted to, it was called the Danneberg movement, and they wanted to reunite southern Schleswig. So we only got northern Schleswig back after the First World War, but they want all of Schleswig back after the after the second one. But it eventually resulted in nothing because it was just it would just create more tensions in Western Europe at
after
this time
the
where they really
World
needed
War,
to band, band yes. together.
Everyone was just like done
and eventually
with
Denmark
border,
and,
border changes. Like, okay,
they just settled everything.
And
also, it had really been settled after the First World War. Also to the, it was a situation which, if we go back to the 1800s, the national liberals actually got their way because the Danes got to live in Denmark and there's only a small Danish minority in northern Germany today. So I guess it worked out like they wanted.
Yeah, so it's along the lines, like the cultural lines, is where the border is. So it's kind
of more or less
natural.
A bit, it was a bit of patchwork. So with with the referendums there after the First World War, there were eventually they got minorities in both countries of the other kind. So there are some Germans, Denmark, and vice versa. But
and
it's not very significant.
I don't know how the referendums were in Denmark. In Czechoslovakia at the time, they also had referendums because that was also an issue that there were, you know, Czech villages there and German villages here. And they just let every village, they just did a referendum in every single village. The problem is that now if you look at a map of the northern border of the Czech Republic, it like zigzags like crazy. You can take one straight road and you'll cross the border 10 times, just going in and out, which in the Cold War was strange. I mean, that was the border between East Germany and Czechoslovakia.
Oh, right.
So, okay. That's fine, I guess. But it's strange because, they just let the people choose. They were like, this is, you know, at the time they're like, let's make it as democratic as we can. Let's ask everybody what country they want to be in. And so I imagine that was kind of similar to
I can't really remember the exact way they did it, but I don't think they got down to that level of
like
micro,
not village to village,
micro border management.
Yeah,
no.
Probably county county or something like region to region
something
or something.
Like that,
because it seems on a map, it seems like the Danish-German border is pretty straight. So, but yeah, if you look at like Saxon-Czech border, it's you'll see what I mean. It's nuts.
Okay, I'll look into that. Actually, there's one more thing I wanted to mention, which I can't believe I didn't actually remember this when we talked about doing this episode. It's the Flensburg Lion. We haven't even talked about that. Have you heard about that?
Uh-uh.
It's a statue in Flensburg.
Uh-uh.
Okay, it's a really cool story, actually, but I haven't written any notes on it, so I'll see if I can just remember it.
Sure.
After the first Schleswig War in 1848, where the Danes won, they ordered a monument built called the Flensburger Löwe, or Flensburg Lion. And it was erected in Flensburg, which was then a Danish city, obviously, or part of Denmark. But then the Germans, after they took the duchies, they sent it to Berlin and paraded it as a victory monument. Like, hey, we got your lion.
Yeah.
Aha, we've beaten you. And then I think maybe it was melted down to cannons or something, like Prussian cannons. But then it was sent back after Denmark and Germany became friends again.
Uh-huh.
I think they made a new one and then sent it back to Flensburg like as a peace monument.
Like, we're sorry.
Something like that. I'm not sure if it was melted down. Maybe that's wrong. But I think maybe it was melted down and then a copy was made later. But basically, people can look that up themselves. It's called the Flensburg Lion.
Yeah, and then later they're like, you know, a triumph through Berlin. Maybe that wasn't so sensitive. We're sorry, Denmark. Here's your lion back. Yeah.
Yes, so. I think it's in a graveyard in Flensburg today as a monument for the wars and everything. And
that makes
and
sense
between Denmark and Germany. I think that's a good note to end on, actually.
There you go. Yeah, it's interesting. So now, I mean, today, if you want to go see it, you have to go to Germany to go see this Danish national symbol, really.
Yeah.
But
it's right up against the border, so Flensburg is like the ideal place for it to be.
Mm-hmm. And
it's kind of like how Strasbourg in between France and Germany is also a symbol of peace between those two countries.
And
kind of the same with Flensburg.
Yeah, and I haven't been to that. I haven't even been to that part of Germany, like that far north, and I haven't been to Denmark. But I do love border regions, like the area where the borders, the cultures mix is just those are
really
my favorite parts of Europe.
Actually, lots of Danes commemorate the peace by going down to the border and buying cheap beer. That's kind of our way of...
That's the tradition now, yeah.
...of celebrating. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, there's a lot of border trade there, so... At Flensburg.
Yeah, so now, yeah, everybody's brothers in the EU, and yeah, we're all happy, so yeah. Yeah, cool. Well,
for now, at least.
Yeah, for temporarily. No, yeah, so, I mean, there's a good 1,500 years of history hidden in that, in those earthworks and that those fortifications there in the Danaverka. So yeah, I just I kept bringing it up in passing. So now I felt like we've kind of done it justice, and that turned into a
really
into
do hope it. Yeah, I hope it goes on the UNESCO World Heritage. They're trying to get it recognized. I think
it really should. I mean, yeah, I think lesser important things are in the UNESCO World Heritage, or like lesser yeah, nationalistic symbols, or you know, that kind of thing. So. Yeah.
I think they made like an application a few years ago, but it takes some time for it to get recognized. So. Maybe in the future.
I'm almost certain that, yeah, it would be. But cool. Well, anyways, it was a pleasure having you on the show. And thanks a lot for coming
on.
Yeah,
thanks for having me.
And and also, in case people want to find your show, why don't you tell them, you know, where people can find Sörlen or, and, you know, what yeah, go ahead. What's your link? And
it's The History of Denmark. Pretty self-explanatory. Just type that in Google and it'll pop up on iTunes, or type it in your podcast app. The website is called thehistoryofdenmark.wordpress.com. So it's a blog page. I do have a Facebook page, The History of Denmark Podcast Listeners.
There you go. Yeah. Just so like that Facebook page and yeah, keep in touch. There you go.
And otherwise, the History of Germany podcast is a member of the Agora Podcast Network. The podcast of the month is The History of Islam, which I also highly recommend. There's a link to that and my other shows on podcastnik.com. That's podcastnik.com. Give Sören's podcast a listen, The History of Denmark. Come find us both on iTunes and give us both a rating, why don't you? That really helps us out. Und bis zum nächsten Mal. Danke fürs Zuhören.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.